Track 5, The Birds of Norfolk, a short story by DJ Taylor.
They woke up in the rented house at Brancaster just after dawn to find dense orange light bursting in through the gaps in the curtains. There was an eerie silence beside and beneath them, which meant that the children were still asleep. And Mark, sensing opportunity, pushed her head into the crook of his shoulder. And in the insouciant way that, even after 10 years of marriage, she still found slightly shocking, said, "What are my chances?" But it was only the second day of the holiday, and she was still exhausted and also annoyed with him for a variety of reasons she could not quite manage to separate out, and so she swung her own shoulder well out of range and said, "Not the faintest chance. Go and make me a cup of tea," and pressed her head back into the pillow. Listening to him crash down the stairs, as the voices of newly roused children sounded in his wake, she reflected that anyone presented with a tape recording of this exchange would automatically assume that it was she who held all the trump cards in their relationship, whereas, in fact, it was the other way around. Still listening to the racket Mark made as he went about brewing the tea and the little irritated noises triggered by his exasperation at not knowing where everything was, she found herself weighing up points for and against him. On the positive side, there was the fact that he was actually making the tea rather than feigning sleep and bamboozling her into doing it, and also attending to Josh and Hattie, who were demanding glasses of milk and biscuits. On the negative side was the ping of his mobile going off. Who on earth could he be in communication with at this hour? And the scheme to move house again, which had been unleashed upon her the previous night over what was supposed to be a relaxing supper in a country pub. Going down the polished pine staircase half an hour later, it was a top-of-the-range let from Norfolk Country Cottages at £2,000 a week, she caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror. Small, blonde-haired and discontented, and wearing a red and white Breton top that gave her a nautical air. But the sight of the breakfast table with its neatly set rows of cutlery and its newly opened flagon of cranberry juice was unexpectedly cheering. Even if Mark was one of those men who made an effort largely so that effort could be publicly commended, at least the effort had been made. "Did you sleep well, Mummy?" Josh asked politely. "Yes, I did," she lied. "Did you?" Josh cried because he thought there was a ghost in the wardrobe, Hattie said loftily. "What are we going to do today?" "Bird reserve this morning, I think," Mark said, coming back from the cooker with a plate of French toast and the mobile phone pinging away in the pocket of his khaki shorts. "Go over to Titchwell and see what's flown in from the Arctic." "Daddy says we're going to the bird reserve," Alice said in a way that she hoped would convey enthusiasm to the children and a mild resentment of decisions made without consultation by Mark. "But nobody, not anybody, not even Daddy, is leaving this house without putting on a hat and some sun cream." "I got some papers ordered from the shop in the village," said Mark, whom she noticed was trying very hard to please. "They should be here in a minute." "That's good," she said, thinking that she would not have cared if she never saw another newspaper in her life, only for Josh to shatter a tumbler by dropping it on the floor, whereupon the thought of what might have prompted this sudden access of solicitude drifted away from her, flew up into the room to settle among the prints of Norfolk shorelines and whirling gulls and prowling avocets, and the real business of the morning slowly took shape beneath her grasp. "Birds," Mark was saying in a high, sing-song voice for the children's benefit as they headed north along the coast road. "Herons and oyster catchers and hoopoes and black-backed gulls." Alice always wondered if his enthusiasm for the avian fauna of the East Coast was quite as serious as he maintained, or simply put on when the occasion suited, like the fleeting interest in international rugby, which mysteriously vanished once the Six Nations was over. She was still cross about last night's conversation, and even crosser about the psychological stirrings that lay behind it. Did Mark really want to move house again, a bare 2 years after they had established themselves at Richmond? Or was it because the bank had given him another bonus? £117,322, according to Mark's precise calculation, and he couldn't think what to do with it. However much magnified, it was the same motivation that, a decade and a half before, whenever the art gallery in which she worked had given her a tiny pay rise, had sent her flying into one of the Jermaine Street boutiques to buy a cheap bracelet. "Oh, and by the way," Mark said, dropping his Mickey Mouse on helium voice to include her in the dialogue, "apparently the Taverners are here this week. I had a text from Freddy. He says, why don't we go round for a drink this evening?" She considered this for a moment as the breeze blew in from the sea to buffet the side of the car, and a stream of ladybirds flung themselves despairingly against the windscreen. "I thought you said they always went to Limoges these days." "Oh, Freddy thinks nobody in France wants to look an Englishman in the eye after Brexit. He says Emma's looking forward to seeing you again." "Well, we must go then," Alice said, who knew her social obligations. On the other hand, she had to concede that, of all of the friends of Mark's introduced to her over the past 10 years, Freddy, who worked in some stratospheric level of corporate finance, and Emma, who appeared to do nothing except sit in their big house in Hampstead snipping articles out of Home and Gardens, were by far the most tedious. Worse, there was some secret compact between Mark and Emma that went back before this, and occasionally expressed itself in anecdotes about people known at Oxford and the memory of saunters across summer lawns. But she was a dutiful girl at heart, so she smoothed her palms against the midriff of her Breton top, ruffled Josh's turbulent hair, told Hattie that Granny was expecting a postcard, and said how nice, how very nice it would be to see Emma again. And in the end, the bird reserve at Titchwell turned out to be just what the doctor ordered. While the children, under Mark's benign supervision, sat meekly in hides, inspecting terns and sandpipers and varieties of intruding gulls, there were people around here who were capable of correcting you when you said seagull, and insisting that you should say herring gull. She browsed the gift shop, brought several tea towels and a jigsaw puzzle for her goddaughter's birthday, drank 2 cups of quite palatable tea, and sent a text to the literary agency for which she worked in a part-time capacity. She was back in the gift shop, worrying whether the jigsaw was a bit too complicated for its beneficiary, when the three of them breezed in to find her. "Did you have a lovely time?" she asked, seeing that Josh looked a bit down in the mouth. "Yes, I did. I saw a snipe, only Daddy said it wasn't a snipe." "Definitely not a snipe," Mark said, looking into the space behind them and betraying by the redness of his face that he had ignored the instructions about sun cream. "Hey," he said, one eye fixed on a protruding bookshelf, "you can get me that for my birthday if you like." In fact, his birthday had been 3 weeks ago, but Alice knew a hint when it was thrown at her. She paid for the book, a stout illustrated paperback called The Birds of Norfolk, at the till, and came back to find the three of them positioned in what she always thought were their most characteristic attitudes. Mark looking about expectantly as if to see what new treat was about to swing into view to entertain him. Josh seeming nervous and put upon. Hattie examining a pile of toy eagles and felt beachscapes in a faintly calculating way, as if weighing up the chances of being allowed to buy one. "Now write in it," Mark said as she handed the book to him. And she wrote on the title page, "For Mark on his 40th birthday, with fond love from Alice." Something which at this particular moment, with the children offering handfuls of shells for her inspection, and the sun flashing off the window frames, and talk of the next house removal, temporarily in abeyance, was, she thought, as near to the truth as made no difference. "I saw Georgie Underwood the other day," Emma said, taking a minuscule sip of wine from her fluted glass. "Oh, did you?" Mark returned, with considerably more animation than Alice remembered him expressing at various comments of her own made earlier in the day. "What's she up to?" "Back in Northumberland with that awful man of hers, I should think," Emma hazarded. "She said if I saw you, I should say Magdalen Bridge, and you'd know what she meant." "Most embarrassing moment of my life," Mark said cheerfully. The Taverner's house was about as upmarket as you could get in this part of Norfolk, with an immense garden and an actual swimming pool in which the children, together with Emma's son Hector, were now gladly disporting themselves. Freddy, who most people thought horribly dull until they were told that he earned 400k a year, was trying to get the cork out of a bottle of Chablis that Alice could see from the label was far more expensive than anything she had drunk in her life. "Now I," Mark said, not wanting to be left out of these news updates from the world of bygone Oxford, "saw Harry Crichton the other day." "No. Is he still with that dreadful Camilla woman?" If these exchanges came close to caricature, then it was because they were meant to. Mark and Emma nearly always upped the conversational ante, as if daring everyone present to chide them for being moneyed, self-absorbed and upper-middle-class twits. What would they start talking about next, Alice wondered, who was dying to get back to the batch of typescripts that the agency had sent her on holiday with. On what tantalising new subject would their shared expertise fall? Over by the swimming pool, she could see that neurotic 8-year-old Hector, next to whom Josh seemed a model of well-adjusted self-confidence, was whinging about something again. The sun was gently declining in the blue, endless sky, and she thought, how nearly but not quite perfect these kind of days could be. "Oh, you've got that one," Mark said, plucking a copy of The Birds of Norfolk off the none-too-crowded bookshelf. "It's terribly good, isn't it?" Emma said. "I always read it when we're here." The book's cover had a suspiciously pristine appearance, as if it had never been opened, but Alice decided to keep quiet about this. Freddy, who seemed practically to have ruptured himself in extracting the cork, advanced on them with a fresh bottle of Chablis and began to top up people's glasses, whether they had asked him to or not. "Amazing, isn't it?" Mark said. "The things that turn up here. You know, rare species that have blown off course into somebody's garden in Brundle or somewhere." "That's right," Emma chimed. "You know, you wouldn't believe it, but they once found a golden eagle flying around here." Hattie and Josh had had enough of Hector and were splashing water over him. Pretty soon he would come howling to his parents. Serve him right, Alice thought unkindly. "No, they didn't," she found herself saying. "Oh, but they did, Allie," Emma thoughtfully corrected her. "I've read about it." "No, they didn't," Alice insisted. She was annoyed not only by Emma's usual omniscience, but by a whole lot of other things. Dim, weak-wristed Freddy and his whinging son. Mark and his secret texting. The bloody new house. Some Victorian gamekeeper might have found one rotting on a salt marsh after it came down from Scotland and died of exhaustion, but that's as far as it goes. If Mark sometimes shied away from uncomfortable truths, then he was usually prepared to back Alice when the chips were down. So it was he who opened the book and read out under the entry for Golden Eagle. One, probably an adult male, was found long dead on the salt marshes at Stiff Key in November 1868 and is the sole record for Norfolk. Shortly afterwards, a snivelling Hector arrived on the terrace clutching his wrist in an odd way, and Freddy, suspecting a fracture, volunteered to drive him to the A&E department at King's Lynn. Later, back at Brancaster, as the children lay somnolent in front of the TV, and the shadows of the apple trees made fantastic patterns over the garden, she sat at the kitchen table reading one of the manuscripts the agency had sent, and watching Mark roaming around in the twilight, talking into his mobile. The Birds of Norfolk, with its tender inscription, sat next to her coffee cup. Sometimes, she thought, the small victories were the best. She darted another glance at Mark, whose beshorted knees were glinting in the pale light, wondered who it was he was talking to, and, remembering the pained expression on Emma's face, was surprised to discover how little she cared.